Hello, and a warm welcome to Upper Bottom, a refreshingly light-hearted sobriety podcast, taking an ambivalent look at giving up boozing for people who haven't hit rock bottom. My name's Ollie.
Hey, I'm Tess. We both gave up drinking in early 2023, and we found that our friends were so curious about sobriety journeys, we decided to start this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Expect a splash of wisdom, a shot of honesty, and a chaser of curiosity each week as we feature embarrassing drinking tales, unusual observations, and expert interviews to try and make sense of sobriety.
So, for anyone rethinking their relationship with alcohol, please join us on Upper Bottom. We're living proof that getting sober doesn't have to be a bum deal.
Cheers! Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Upper Bottom. We're recording this on the 1st of April. Pinch, punch, first of the month, white rabbits. No returns. And we're going to kick off with some booze news today, aren't we, Cess?
Yeah, happy Easter.
Happy Easter, yeah.
For a special Easter episode.
So the first item of booze news is wine the 2024 cigarette? Younger generations say all alcohol is literally poison. And this comes out of, I think it's San Francisco, actually, but it was about a social media influencer, Warner Boyne. She posted a video on her TikTok page. She's interested in wine trends and alcohol trends, and she asked asked Generation Z and millennials to explain why they're not drinking wine.
1.6 million views, if only.
Yeah, one day, Cess. Maybe we need to be on TikTok. Maybe that's what's required. But yeah, the response generated 1.6 million views and nearly 35,000 comments. And it reveals a growing view among younger people that alcohol is poison. And this is something that we've touched upon a little bit in the past. I mean, we are very much on the fence. We're ambivalent. Mm. But there seems to be this groundswell of opinion that boozing's bad.
Well, certainly amongst certain parts of the younger cohort of drinkers or non-drinkers. I wonder whether the kind of people who are questioned would be...
I think it's sort of...
I still see lots of people who are under 25 pretty hammered Friday night when, you know, you go to your sort of smaller market towns.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a kind of, dare I say, a class-based difference in behaviours.
Maybe. Yeah.
So while this is certainly true, 1.6 million viewers can't be wrong.
How many are bots, though? Maybe, yeah, people are whistling the same tune as you say. But anyway, it's interesting. And this lady, Warner Boyne, partnered with a data analyst to dig deeper into the feedback. She found that health concerns accounted for 20% of responses, many of which referred to alcohol as toxic. Poison, or as the headline suggested, the 2024 cigarette.
I think that is pretty insightful because if you look at how cigarettes are now considered like a pariah product, I think that is interesting how they're perceived amongst the younger generation and whether we'll see that continue. And, you know, going back to one of your anecdotes to pop up at a kid's party with a four-pack of beers, it's a bit like, you know, you wouldn't show up with 20 Benson, would you?
No, exactly.
But I wonder if we were to look in 20 years' time.
Yeah.
To show up at a children's party with a bottle of Prosecco, which is kind of almost de rigueur now.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in the daytime, that would be considered bad behaviour.
Well, some of the people that we've spoken to feel as though there's currently a barrier. It will always be socially acceptable. But actually, as you've pointed out, you were in the pub, weren't you? And when the smoking ban came in and people were saying, it's never going to happen. But actually, it was those small pockets where change did happen. And then it happened quite quickly.
Really quickly. Once you've rolled back the sort of principle of it not being acceptable in one place or one social environment, you just kind of extend that window, don't you?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So another one here from The Guardian. Always guaranteed to make you feel good. This is Ash Davenport. I stopped drinking 3 months ago. It's not as simple as the internet made it look.
And we've got to thank a friend of the pod, Ryan, for this one. He sent this our way.
So he will be pushing around 3 months. No, he's on 4 months. No, 3 months.
He's just done 3 months, isn't he?
This is him now. So perhaps that's why the online sober community, of which we are now aware of doing this sort of stuff, can make it feel quite easy.
Yeah.
And there's lots of pictures of lots of kind of before and after stuff, lots of quite holier than thou kind of images. and, you know, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me, et cetera, et cetera. But what she says is that everything has been smooth around the edges. She was kind of looking back and thinking that things aren't so easy as perhaps they say. I do not look back at my years of drug and alcohol use with zero regrets. I have infinite regrets. My cup runneth over.
But in the same way that, she might have regrets, she might also remember those good times and you know, celebrate them as well. There seems to be this polarization, this black and white. Booze is bad.
Yeah.
Sober is good.
And anything you did before, you should kind of put in a box marked really awful. Yeah, and this good news for us here, actually, Ollie, because what she's missing is I'm left craving messy, intimate details about their struggles with alcohol so I can feel less alone in mine.
Well, Ash, we can definitely help.
We've got loads of those. But they don't owe me anything. I wouldn't expect a stranger in the supermarket to step me through their darkest hour.
Well, this is exactly where we're pitched, aren't we? At upper bottom, we are looking at the sober journey and being honest about it.
What's
and it's all? Not all, yeah, it's not all rainbows and bikinis on top of mountains.
Yeah.
Less in your case, actually. I mean, you're topless thing of the week.
But I think, in general, don't people choose to present a sanctified version of themselves online?
Social media, of course they do.
Especially, you know, in the wellness community, which there's an overlay, isn't there, between wellness and the sober curious kind of online community. Lots of pictures of people in tattoos looking amazing on mountains.
Yeah. But it's that, I mean, it's the general problem with social media is to get those clicks, to get those likes, you have to go to one extreme or the other, and the nuance is lost, which is hopefully what we're providing here.
Yeah, messy, intimate details.
Messy, intimate details. That's what we're here for. The third and final piece of booze news this week is something that my mum picked out, actually, in the Times. Women's heart disease risk rises after more than one drink a day. Women who drink more than one glass of wine a day are 45% more likely to develop heart disease, new research shows. A bit gloomy, this one, maybe, but perhaps, yeah, surprising that it can affect, you know, raising blood pressure, causing inflammation, even in young adults.
I'm always surprised. I mean, we've looked at these numbers so many times, but when they class a moderate drinker as 3 to 7 drinks for women, that would be like hardly scratching the surface.
That midweek book club, isn't it?
Yeah. So if that's a week, it basically means everyone, ourselves included, that we drunk with are clearly high intake users. And that's the thing that always strikes me when I look at these things. I think it's really hard to stay within those limits. But yeah. So their blood supply is blocked or interrupted 3 drinks in a single night by a buildup of fatty substances. Yeah, blocking arteries and could cause symptoms. Yeah, so certainly sobering stuff there.
And it's, you know, add on top all the chocolate you've had over Easter. You're in trouble, right?
So speaking of Easter, today is a special day. Give us a tell.
It is actually, yeah. 1st of April marks a whole calendar year since I stopped drinking. And are you going to get your water? I thought you were going to get me a little trophy. yes, and looking back, I mean, one of the triggers was being at a school party for the end of the Easter term and getting far too drunk and being a bit embarrassed about it. So I've been reflecting on how I was feeling then and how I feel now. There's a marked difference, really. Lots of people, perhaps people I haven't seen for a while, and we'll come on to that, are saying how good I'm looking, how much younger I'm looking. Meaning, in conjunction with not drinking, I'm perhaps exercising a bit more as well. So there's a sort of double win there. But I think more than that, I've got a better sense of really who I am and where I'm going. And I asked my family last night, you know, what they think, how they think I am now. And my son, Freddie, said, "You're certainly a lot less moody."
Oh.
Which was interesting. I don't know. I feel much more clear and confident as to where I'm going. There was quite a good quotation that I saw, which was, when you quit drinking, you stop waiting. And this is from Caroline Knapp. And she wrote Drinking, A Love Story, which was her 20-year battle with alcoholism. She died 20 or so years ago. But I really feel that. I feel as though maybe I was waiting. Maybe I wasn't being, you know, the social media influencers are being their best self. They're bringing their whole self. No, I wasn't. I was, you know, hiding almost.
Procrastinating?
Definitely procrastinating. Mm. I mean, I look at the things that I've done in the last year. Mm. I've explored my hobbies more. I've made, you know, more hobbies, for better or for worse. But, you know, we've set up this podcast. I'm exercising more. I set up the book club.
Yeah.
It's arguably my most successful year.
Mm.
And I think a large part of that is because I've had more time on my hands. I'm finding myself getting up earlier and just really motivated by the day that lies ahead. And
in the day.
You're 3 months ahead of me now. I mean, what are your reflections?
I like to think that I quite live in the moment, which is good in lots of ways. But the problem with that is that I find it quite hard to remember how things were like even in the recent past.
Yeah.
And I don't keep a diary. So my recollections of how I used to feel, it seems like quite a long time ago now. Although, you know, if you're in your late 40s, it's only a year. So, yeah, I agree with all the things you said. But I don't have, like, every day I don't wake up and go, oh, it's amazing, I don't drink anymore.
No.
I don't think that. Probably moody sometimes. Well, I'm told I'm still moody sometimes.
Of course.
But, yeah, I just think things are generally a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And I think it's I don't know, if you're going to try and attach an incremental number to it, I don't know. Even if things were only 10 to 20% easier on a daily basis, in terms of everything you do being 20% easier, well, that's going to add up over the course of a year.
Yeah.
I think it's something like that. And also, I don't suffer from that sort of feeling of regret. Definitely don't have as much regret.
No.
Although, something that we talked about the other day is that what I do think is that when you've been doing this for as long as we have, the initial part is great and all the things you've just mentioned. However, I think there's a period sort of 6 months in, or maybe even later, where you walk past a pub at 10 o'clock.
Mm.
You're on your way home, maybe, and you see people in that kind of Patrick Hamilton-esque
convivial
frenzy,
warm,
and there's a pang of mourning or loss, because you're mourning an element of your old life, and by now you've probably realised that this isn't just a break.
Yeah,
this is something that you don't want to go back to.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, first question: When have you felt the biggest pangs? When have you been, well, not necessarily closest to wanting to have a pint or a glass of wine, but, you know, what's been the biggest almost trigger there? And I forgot my second question. Let's go for that first one.
Struggling to think of a particular moment. It's more just a general type feeling, but with it comes a kind of a mourning for all the times that I maybe messed up a little bit.
That was going to be my second question, actually. Have you found yourself being a bit more judgmental of other people?
I try not to. More judgmental of my former self.
Yeah.
But I try to work against that, because there's no point, as we said, because if you go down that route, you end up like an ex-smoker.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want that, because I do go to pubs quite a lot, and I do like convivial spaces, which I think are really important. So it's a balance, isn't it, to strike? And that's another thing that I find a little bit off-putting by the online community, is it can kind of denigrate pubs or people drinking, which I don't want to join in with. In a way, I kind of think, we talked a lot about moderation. I'm a little bit sad that I probably couldn't nail moderation, because I think deep down, we'll talk about this soon, where does this stuff end with us not drinking?
Yeah.
Do we then have to make everybody else not drink?
Yeah.
Is that the goal of this podcast? Do we evangelicalize our mission? It's not for me.
No, absolutely not for me as well. We want to help people through, you know.
But it may
we
well
want to inform and maybe inspire, but we're not, you know, that is not the goal, to make everyone sober.
But I think I think one should have an idea of where they want to go with this stuff, because it's very easy to slip into, this has been great for me, you should do this.
Mm.
Or, well, you're feeling rubbish because you had a drink last night. Mm. And I don't think that's the way I want to take things.
We went for a walk yesterday down just to the local shop, and there's a little park in between our house and the park. And there was a lovely family gathering in the park, and they've created a little bivouac of sort of sticks and trunks. And so while this family party gathering was going on, there were three adults doing drugs in this little wooden gathering. I don't know what they were doing. Smoking something or other. I mean, it was hard drugs. It wasn't spliff.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, that's not good. And so we walked a bit further on, and just to the side of the park, there was another cluster of three people doing Class A's, whatever it was they were doing.
On a early Sunday.
And a guy, as he saw me coming past, you know, I've got young children as well. And I just, I don't know, I couldn't help but sort of frown. He said, "You're right." And I said, "Well, what are you doing? Yeah. There's a family gathering here." And that was it. That was all the interaction was. But I suppose being an upper bottom, this guy was younger than me. I mean, they were younger than me, these people. And I suppose that's the kind of worry, isn't it? That if you start with something, it's a gateway to something else that would lead you to rock bottom. Mm. I mean, that was a pretty horrible scene. Shocking.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if things had played out and I'd listened to, you know, the darker thoughts, maybe I could have been that person,
Right. And you think that people often talk about other drugs as being the gateway drugs.
Mm.
Your thesis might be that alcohol might be the gateway drug.
Well, it's just, I remember reading an interview with Carrie Fisher, and she obviously had her problems with drinking drugs. But I think the line that she used was, "I just wanted to get on the train, whether it was drink or drugs, and get out of there, you know, and just sort of whichever way it was, she was going to get off her head."
Yeah, I do think it's, that's insightful, that society often lists, want of a better word, soft drugs as the way that people get into hard drugs, when actually I wonder if that journey for most people, the sort of psychoactive drug that most people have first, is going to be booze, right?
Yeah.
But it's never listed as a gateway drug or discussed in that way.
Well, this is it, you know, if you say, oh, you know, I'm giving up cocaine, or, you know, I'm giving up marijuana or whatever, people will congratulate you for that.
Yeah.
But yet, if you give up alcohol, which is, you know, arguably, Professor David Nutt has said that it's the most damaging drug of all.
In all ways.
You're kind of, there isn't that congratulation. It's really, it's a sort of, oh, what's the problem with you?
Yeah. Can't you just have one line a week?
Yeah. Can you not moderate your cocaine intake?
Well, yeah. You know, what about just birthdays? But, you know, it's never gets said, does it?
No.
Society and its relationship to drink and drugs. So this leads us nicely on to Lent. I think it would be useful to, I hate this term, take a deep dive into Lent. And this came about when our friend at the Blythe Hill Tavern mentioned it. And he was, and it's obviously everyone has the pancakes.
This is John the barman. Who I was asking him if he would break Lent.
Yeah.
For St. Patrick's Day, and the great quote was, "I'm there with Jesus 40 days, 40 nights.
40 days and 40 nights in the desert." So Matthew, Mark and Luke all talk about Jesus having this extended time where he was literally struggling with these demons, that's bookended by Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, and then Easter Sunday. And that bit in the middle is the bit where you abstain. So I thought, I mean, really, this is where the whole concept of Stocktober or Dry January comes from.
Mm.
This is the original, the OG kind of abstinence month, isn't it? So I thought, let's dig into this and see what we can learn. So there's many things that people give up. Chocolate, sugar, sweets, alcohol, soda. But it all depends on the sort of particular denomination that you're in.
You mean soda as in pop?
Yeah, exactly. American term, isn't it? Worryingly enough, Ollie, temperance drinks experience a surge of popularity during the Lenten season. And if you look at when we've been doing this, it almost overlays entirely with the Lenten season. So are we going to see a big drop? No, everyone's
possibly.
Everyone's into the fun part of the year. Camping, barbecues, let's watch out. Anyway, so the other thing, and I'm struck with the similarities between Lent and abstinence, and also how many people are looking at abstinence in terms of alcohol now.
Mm.
So when you'd give up stuff at Lent, so this could be using profanities, as I said, or eating meat, Christians would say to you, may God bless your Lenten sacrifice.
Mm.
So again, the community
mm.
sort of says, well done, good on you. I mean, that sounds quite similar to keep on going, mate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Really, really simple. We just change the words. But it's not just Christianity that has these periods of fasting. For Muslims, you have the month of Ramadan.
Yeah.
And they're in the Hindu tradition, they abstain from eating meat, but all the time, actually. So they don't have set periods of abstinence, but they have sort of dietary prohibitions on eating sort of various things. So
it's, obviously drink as well.
Yes, yes, that's true. And actually, the temperance movement in India was overlaid with anti-colonialist thought as well, because they sort of felt that alcohol was something that was put upon their society.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, actually, because in the interview with Amanda Thompson, owner of Thompson Scott and Naughty Wine, she was saying that the US is her biggest market, and she thought it might have something to do with prohibition and actually backlash.
Well, it's...
Or response, let's say.
Yeah, so we'll come to prohibition in a sec. But yeah, so another thing that struck me in terms of similarities between Lent and, I don't know, Dry January, is that the person that takes on the pledge or stopping drinking, they have like a close relationship with their soul almost, and also the sober community. And if you think about Pilgrim's Progress, you know, that sort of key Protestant track, in a way, if you think of something like Drop the Bottle,
mm.
there's many similarities. They, you know, you
drop, get a, Drop the Bottle being the Instagram
page. Yeah. Which so you get like,
great.
Well, a little sound bites.
Yeah.
You get little sound bites, you get a nice little image, basically to keep us on the right path.
Yeah.
So I wonder if,
yeah,
many ways, we're just reflecting things that have happened in the past.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's all about a rejection of the self, the sort of bodily self.
Yeah.
And the appetites that come by giving into the bodily self, and ultimately by sort of abstaining, you and having a spiritual discipline, you get access to a higher plane, yeah. almost a greater awareness. Isn't that stuff so redolent of what's going on with the sober curious movement?
Yes, absolutely. Well, just again reflecting on my year of sobriety, I think it is. I have become more aware of myself, more clear and more confident, and it is like I've got a bit of a new lease of life.
Yeah.
But I'm making bolder decisions as a result of this.
Do you feel born again?
Well, not necessarily born again, but just more sort of ineffably me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. So, maybe...
so I've now got an earring. I went to the Champions League final last year. Yeah. Thank goodness they won. It's quite stressful. But these are things that perhaps I wouldn't have done previously. There is also, you know, health benefits, decreased liver fat, lowered harmful cholesterol levels, improved sleep quality. But I'm reaching out to old friends as well. I'm refinding myself.
Yeah, well, that's
a little bit.
So it does sound like you've got an improved sort of hotline to yourself.
Yeah,
in the way that, you know, a sort of Protestant would have an improved hotline to God.
Yeah,
you know, by reading the Bible. I think there's something really interesting. If you look at the parts of the world where the temperance movement took off, so a bit of a real quick sort of wrap up on the temperance movement. Again, there's nothing new about people in the West not drinking.
Yeah,
this was a huge, huge, huge movement that happened in the 19th century that really cast a long shadow into today. So the temperance movement was initially promoting moderation and abstinence from spirits.
Right.
So it wasn't all drink.
Right.
Spirits were seen as the real bad guys.
Yeah.
And later abstinence.
What spirits are we talking about?
So you'd be talking about whiskey,
gin,
moonshine. Yeah, and if you're 40% distilled, because there's stuff that would really make you go a bit loopy, right? And teetotalism is named for the idea of a capital T, meaning total abstinence.
Uh-huh.
So it came later. So early 19th century, in 1830, the average American consumed at least 7 gallons of alcohol a year. And to put that in perspective, that's ethanol. That's neat. It's 2.51 at the moment. It gives you an idea.
People were drinking. Guts, is it?
So people were a lot more boozy than they were now.
Fascinating. I would never have thought that.
What? There'd be more boozy?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And again, there's an association with the church and in particular, evangelical Christianity. Listen to this. And if you change a few of the words, this could be written yesterday. The movement combined a concern for general social ills with religious sentiment and practical health considerations in a way that was appealing to many middle-class reformers.
Mm.
Women in particular were drawn to temperance in large numbers. Temperance reformers blamed demon rum for corrupting popular culture and leading to violence, immorality, and death. I mean, again, that's not unlike a lot of the stuff we're hearing now. So
I've got to say, just on rum,
yeah,
that was my go-to drink.
Was it?
Rum, bit of ginger. I went to Cuba Libres, rum and Coke.
Nice.
Yeah, lovely. I think that's the spirit I miss most. Sorry,
this having the wrong impact. So it wasn't just the States. Britain, Norway, Sweden all had their own temperance movement, as did lots of other parts of the English-speaking world, Australia, Canada, etc. So why was this? I think there was a feeling that the post-industrial world needed workers to be equipped for the new age. So actually, this was middle-class people saying, we need working-class people to be better equipped to do these really horrible jobs in factories. But yes, social reformers seeking to improve the lives of everyone.
The reason, I suppose at the same time, maybe the Industrial Revolution was happening as well.
So that's right. The two things were happening in tandem. But you asked why people drank a lot more. So people didn't drink water because water was dangerous.
Yeah.
So for most of sort of European, at least, as far as I'm aware, of the past, very low alcohol beer or wine was the drink of choice because the water would literally kill you. Milk was not always available and it had to be chilled. So, you know, up until, I'd say, you know, the advent of the Industrial Revolution and even past, actually, that's where people drank.
Mm.
So that was the drink.
Of course, beer itself has, you know, religious connotations,
well,
isn't it?
Wine,
yeah.
Eucharist, communion.
The blood of,
You know, so in our society, alcohol is very much deeply ingrained. But gin came around in the 18th century, not a British invention, a Dutch invention, Dutch courage.
They're so innovative, Dutch, aren't they? You know, the compact disc, the razor.
But we were the ones that popularised it. And there was a big fear that gin would lead to disorder and a breakdown in society. So some other sort of big communities that were anti-booze. Methodists, the Quakers, all very influential. Cadbury chocolate, fries.
Quakers, of course, yeah.
The Salvation Army.
Right.
So all these groups were very, very sort of pro-temperance. And the Wesleyan Methodists even built halls, large venues, which hosted cheap concerts, comedy shows and films intended to keep the urban working classes away from public houses. Uh-huh. So this was a big, big deal. Towards the end of the 1800s, after the American Civil War, you had lots more immigration from Germany and in Ireland.
Yes.
And these people brought their own habits
and
their customs with them. And that's where all the major American brewers come from.
Yeah, of course.
So that's where even more brewing happened. So beer became a very big thing. But it was a very successful movement, the temperance movement. There was a lady called Carrie Nation. And what she used to do, she was a big celeb at the time. She'd go to pubs and pharmacies with an axe and attack them.
She'd have been good on TikTok, wouldn't she?
Hatchet job. That's where it comes from.
Oh, really?
Exactly.
It was a hatchet job.
Carrie Nation.
Why didn't people stop her, though?
Well, they did. She was arrested 30 times. She described herself as a bulldog running along at the feet of Jesus, barking at what he doesn't like.
Gosh.
And she'd give people little hammers and hatchets to say they've been hatcheted. So another...
That's great.
I've got a factoid for you here. Your favourite football team.
Yes.
Main Road was the old ground. Took its name from a street that had been renamed Main Road by members of the local temperance movement.
Uh-huh.
Vin Tonic, concocted in 1908 as a healthy alternative to alcohol and originally sold in temperance bars.
You know what? I know one of the Vimto family.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
He was a good mate of mine at school. And they have this weird thing, a bit like the royal family. There's only 5 people that are allowed to know the secret recipe and they can't travel together.
Wow.
I think he now knows the secret recipes that have gone through the ranks. Yeah.
But yeah, so temperance fountains, you still see these. So even the architecture of our our cities in Europe and the States, there are these fountains that were erected by temperance societies to provide working people with access to clean drinking water. Mm. They wouldn't have to go to pubs. Jesus said, whoever drinketh of the water shall thirst again, but whoever drinketh of the water I shall give him shall never thirst. Queen Victoria donated loads of money. So where does this all lead, temperance? Well, in the States, as you said earlier on, it led to prohibition.
Yep.
The 18th Amendment, which criminalized production and supply, but not consumption, which is why you could go to a speakeasy.
Yeah, it's a bit like in Dubai, isn't it?
Partly on the back of anti-German propaganda. So the First World War allowed people to say, brewing beer is German.
Mm.
It's traitorous. It passed very easily, broadly across all the political spectrum. And prohibition was not just in the US. Canada, Sweden, Finland also practiced prohibition. So it didn't work in this country. But
they tempted it. I mean,
what they did was they had these drinking laws, which came about at the same time as the First World War, which basically limited the supply of alcohol. So the alcoholic landscape that we live in terms of pubs, whereby sale is limited between, well, it used to be 11 and 3, and then again at 5:30 through to 11, they were worried that people wouldn't be in a fit state to be able to make the munitions.
Of course, yeah.
And they kept it after the war because there was a feeling that, you know, people being in pubs all day wasn't good.
Mm-mm.
So I guess to summarise, my point is that, so temperance didn't work in this country, and it didn't work in the States because of organised crime ended up making those money out of it, and you criminalised loads of people. But arguably, the States accepted that this stuff was bad for you and then tried to limit its sale and choose who could sell it and where. So in a way, we're still living in the landscape that the temperance movement created.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the AA has, you have to submit to a higher power. You know, religion very much hangs over all of this.
Very much so. If you look at how different religions look at alcohol, there are Protestant sects who totally abstain, as I mentioned, the Quakers and the Methodists. The Catholics take a slightly more ambivalent view of it, actually. So their sort of feeling is that everything is fine in moderation. Because if you think about it, you've got lots of Catholic saints. Mm. Saint Armand is the saint of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Saint Vincent is the patron saint of wine. Mm. Yeah, but their feeling is very much that of the moderate view. I mean, it's clearly something that we still live with at the moment. But most people have never heard of it, right?
Yeah.
But it seems so similar to what's going on now. So many of the slogans, so many of the ways people are thinking about it in terms of their journeys. I just think
it's just a modern rebrand.
Yeah, I think so. That's what my research has kind of led me to believe, that there's nothing particularly new about abstinence. It's as old as drinking itself, almost.
Mm.
And these sort of struggles that people go through with it. Is it a spiritual one? In our apparently godless age, we still seem to use...
Well, that's what's fascinating, yeah.
We still seem to use a lot of this language.
Yeah. Well, plenty to ponder there.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. I think in the past, one of the things that I've had a problem with sobriety is the word itself. I think, the synonyms are serious, sensible, and solemn. And I mean, that's almost, I guess, priest-like. And I think sobriety for me has been anything but that. Yes, I suppose it has been more sensible, but in terms of being serious or solemn, I've done some really interesting things this year that I wouldn't have done before.
Yeah, there's nothing like the solemnity of regret and feeling awful, right?
I guess, yeah.
You know, the day after, that's very solemn.
Yeah.
So do you think, you know, that idea of maybe...
Maybe we need another word. That's what I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It has lots of kind of negative connotations. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, fun. I mean, you know, you're solemn, you're sensible.
Puritanical.
Yeah.
And
again, another religious word.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we should give the last word to Martin Luther himself, who, as I said, was a bit of a moderator. We must not reject or condemn anything because it is abused. Wine and women bring a man to misery and make a fool of him. So we would need to kill all the women and pour out all the wine. In dealing with drunkenness at the love feast in Corinth, St. Paul does not require total abstinence from drink, but love for one another would express itself in moderate, selfless behaviour.
Yeah. he'd probably be quite popular on TikTok and social media as well, wouldn't he? Very divisive.
So, yeah. So where do we stand? Maybe have we burnt our bridges when it comes to moderation? That's the thing. So,
yeah. I
think that's kind of where we are, isn't it? We don't. I'd probably agree with Luther in that. If there's no point getting rid of everything that might cause you harm.
Mm-hmm.
Again, should you never get in a car because you might have an accident?
Mm-hmm.
Should you never have a drink of alcohol because this might, you know, you might end up here? No. But in our cases, I think it's probably the right path to take.
Yeah. Exactly. And before we go, I've just got to give a quick shout out to Danny Isherwood. I didn't know this, but after my story about cutting my chin open playing rugby, or after celebrating a rugby victory, I only found out this last weekend by connecting with old friends. It was in the age before anyone had mobile phones.
Yeah.
And because I was running away from the paramedic because I didn't want to go to hospital, I didn't want to get into trouble. Danny got a train from Hazel Grove to New Mills and then ran 4 miles in the dark to go and alert this mate's, Ashley's dad, so he could then meet me at Stepping Hill Hospital.
Wow.
So I just wanted to say a quick thank you to Danny. Amazing.
And look forward to more gritty tales.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Have you used them all up now?
No, there's plenty left. More, don't worry about that. But I know, yeah, just a year in, I feel as I'm still on this journey, you know. There's plenty more to do. I haven't found a reason to go back to drinking yet. I think the closest I came, the biggest pangs that I felt were when my dad said he was going wine tasting in France, and also catching up with a Dutch friend came over almost exactly a year ago. So I suppose it was quite early on then. We went walking in Bristol and caught up with him in the pub. Then I was very close to ordering. Oh. But the actual fact, he had a couple of pints and they had non-alcoholic beer in this pub. And he ended up drinking non-alcoholic beer, maybe out of solidarity for me.
Yeah.
But that was great.
Yeah.
And I haven't felt anything really
since then. No, it's a crutch, isn't it? And I think it gets easier to leave the crutch at home.
Well, there's just a great variety of non-alcoholic options now. Loads of beers. We're finding more out about non-alcoholic wines. I've been recommended a few, actually, since some recent episodes. So we'll have to dig into those a bit more. So I think there are more grown-up non-alcoholic drinks on offer, which, yeah, have that placebo effect.
Yeah, I went to a pub quiz on Friday with some of the chaps.
You came fourth. What was that about? First the worst, second the best, third the worst. Fourth the golden eagle.
Yeah, I mean, I only joined halfway through.
Okay, fine.
But it was good. There was like that kind of vibe in the pub, a bit chatty. The quiz master was like very sort of vivacious character. He sounded like one of these. He sounded like you. Do you know when you go to a fun fair? He talked like this. 20 for speed on the TriStar. And he asked all the questions in that voice, which kept me amused.
What was your team name?
What was the team name?
Yeah.
Can't say it.
It's not suitable for the podcast.
It wasn't my idea. And fourth, quiz in my pants.
Oh, my gosh.
Terrible.
I've got a suspicion who might have selected that one. But sorry for that, listeners.
It wasn't me.
No. Well, thanks a lot for listening. Yeah. And let us know what you think. Thanks a lot for all the feedback that's coming. Thanks a lot for all the questions and the love.
Nice. Enjoy your day, guys. All the best. Bye-bye.
Cheers.